Alexa, what day is today?
It's Wednesday, May 23rd.
Alexa, where am I?
You're in New York.
Alexa, what's the weather?
It's 67 degrees Fahrenheit with cloudy skies. Today's forecast has partly sunny weather, with a high of 81 degrees and a low of 62 degrees.
Do you know who has your personal data? Well, let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcast of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also available on prn.fm, and on our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, then the programs are, well, somewhat different. Next Monday, May 28th, is Memorial Day. It is an American holiday observed on the last Monday of May, honoring the men and women who died while serving in the United States military. It was originally known as Decoration Day. It originated in the years following the Civil War and became an official federal holiday in 1971. Memorial Day is a solemn day of remembrance for everyone who has died serving in the American Armed Forces. Many people confuse Memorial Day and Veterans Day. Memorial Day is a day for remembering and honoring military personnel who died in the service of their country, particularly those who died in battle or as a result of wounds sustained in battle. Veterans Day celebrates the service of all U.S. military veterans. The Federal Communications Commission is alerting consumers, especially seniors, to a new round of fraudulent robocalls. It is estimated that one-third of all phone calls are now unwanted robocalls. Be on the alert for these particular scams. Spoofing your area code so it appears that the call is local. Threatening to turn off your utilities unless an immediate payment is forwarded. Get a discount on utility bills if you wire money elsewhere first. Bogus phone numbers appearing to be from the IRS and then proceeding to collect a non-existent bill. Paying upfront fee to get a 0% credit card. Take heed of these scam alerts from the Federal Communications Commission. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data? Four of the largest cell giants in the United States are selling your real-time location data to a company that you probably never heard of before. Securus, S-E-C-U-R-U-S, is a prison technology company that they can track any phone within seconds by using data obtained from the country's largest cell giants, including AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint, through an intermediary company, Location Smart. The New York Times reported a former police sheriff snooped on phone location data without a warrant. The sheriff has pleaded not guilty to charges of unlawful surveillance. Yet, little is known about how Location Smart obtained the real-time location data on millions of Americans and how the required consent from cell user owners was obtained and who else has access to the data. Kevin Bankston, director of New America Open Technology Institute, explained in a phone call that the Electronic Communication Privacy Act only restricts telecom companies from disclosing data to the government. It doesn't restrict disclosure to other companies, whom then may disclose the same data back to the government. He calls that a loophole. Hey, that's one of the largest gaps in U.S. privacy law. The issue doesn't appear to have been directly litigated before, but because of the way that the law only restricts disclosure by these types of companies to the government. Location Smart is a California-based technology company and is one of a handful of so-called data aggregators. It claims to have direct connections to cell carriers' networks to obtain real-time cell phone location data from nearby cell towers. It is less accurate than using GPS, but cell tower data won't drain a phone battery and doesn't require a user to install an app. Verizon, one of the many cell carriers that sell access to its vast amounts of customer location data, counts LocationSmart as a close partner. The company boasts coverage of 95% of the country, thanks to its access to sell to all the major U.S. carriers, including U.S. Cellular, Virgin, Boost, and Metro PCS, as well as Canadian carriers like Bell, Rogers, and Telus. LocationSmart employs the same technology used to enable emergency assistance, and this includes cell towers and cell sector location, assisted GPS, and cell tower in trilateration. With these location sources, they're able to locate virtually any U.S.-based mobile devices. A person's precise location can be returned in as little as 15 seconds. Other companies then buy access to LocationSmart's data, or the data is obtained by a customer of LocationSmart, which is said to have supplied location data to Securus. LocationSmart also said it allows some customers to obtain implied consent used on a case-by-case basis when the nature of the service implies that location will be used. The company said one example could be when a stranded motorist calls roadside assistance and the event implies the person is calling to be found. The company even has its own Try Before You Buy page that lets you test the accuracy of its data. Ron Wyden, a Democratic senator from Oregon, called on each carrier to stop sharing data with third parties. He said, "It's important for us to close off that potential loophole that can easily be done with one line of legislative language. Hey, just go ahead and do it then." Wyden has also called on the FCC to investigate the carriers for allegedly not obtaining user consent. The Electronics Frontier Foundation, that's EFF, said law enforcement may be violating the law by not seeking data directly from the phone carriers. Law enforcement shouldn't have unfettered access to this data, whether they get it from Securus or directly from the phone companies. Usability testing should always be part of quality control testing. Developers, after a final test, goes to quality control before the product is rolled out. They basically test that all functions work as specified. Usability testing is a little different. Usability testing is a non-functional testing technique that is a measure of how easily the system can be used by end users. It is difficult to evaluate and measure, but can be evaluated based on the use of a product. Ring was purchased by Amazon for about $1 billion earlier this year. This is likely to be a bit of a black eye from Amazon as the company looks to bolster its presence in the home security space. The information reports that until earlier this year, a security loophole allowed users to continue to view a feed from Ring's doorbell camera even after its password was changed. The update arrived after a Miami man told the company that his ex had continued to watch the feed after he had updated the password. So what was the problem? The update doesn't occur immediately. This issue will no doubt lead many users to think twice before introducing a cloud-connected device to their home. You don't know when the update is actually implemented on the back end. You can set up a special password for delivery by Amazon. You assume that once delivery has been confirmed, you would immediately change the password. But if you don't know when it's actually changed, you have no security. Last week, we talked about the demonstration given by Google called Duplex AI. It was a demonstration of AI and voice technology. The demo involved a new AI assistant making phone calls to two businesses, a hairdresser and a restaurant, to make an appointment and to book a reservation, respectively. The calls were quite impressive because the AI response was far more human than your typical voice assistant. It pauses, it says, in the same way a human might, while considering options. When the reservation taker at the restaurant confuses the AI request, the AI doesn't start jabbering away nonsense. It doesn't even get all flustered.
Both demos were quite impressive, but the restaurant demo was the one that made many of the people in the audience sit up and blink. However, the initial and immediate responses were skepticism by the computer press. They noted oddities such as the businesses never identified themselves. The human picking up the phone never gave out their names. There was no ambient background noise. The reservation takers never requested information. No contact phone number. No name. Many critics says it's extremely rare to contact someone at a place of business and not be given either the name of the business, the name of the speaker, or both. Even something as simple as, "This is so-and-so, how may I help you?" tells the person on the other end of the phone that they reach a company as opposed to a personal line. There was some skepticism over whether the demonstration of Duplex on stage or are in fact real or fake, and calls made to actual businesses. However, some Twitter users seem to have successfully tracked down one restaurant that Google did call, and they reported that the employee confirmed it did receive a call. Bloomberg claims that some of the demo recordings were edited to remove identifying information about the recipients. Many states require consent from both parties for phone calls to be recorded, so it's a necessary step. Google plans to share that information in every call, not just in one where it is forced to do so by law. Google presented a situation in which an AI assistant could respond to unexpected conversation in a real-world scenario. And it entirely is possible that the reason Google partially or completely staged the demo is because it can't guarantee that the person on the other end of the phone will have an accent that the AI cannot understand. It may not be able to guarantee that the conversation won't take a turn where the AI can't handle it and Google would be embarrassed. And it may not be able to promise that the AI would understand the information provided depending on how that information is verbally ordered. The uproar that followed Google's demonstration of Duplex spanned a range of emotions, from amazement at the technology to deep concern over ethics. And the company has tried to resolve apprehension about Duplex since, and Duplex will launch its experimental form this summer and allow consumers to have it call businesses to make restaurant reservations or as well as hair appointments. Google said that Assistant Duplex would record calls so that users could review the conversations later on to see how things went. Google emphasized that transparency in the technology is important, and they said that they'll make sure that the system is appropriately identified. Now we know that it'll probably be something like a friendly, "Hi, this is Google Assistant," and with a greeting response that still sounds real enough to pass as an actual person. However, the whole thing still sounds creepy. But I think that the company passed the Turing test.
Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data?
Any pre-installed apps on a phone are from negotiations with the company and either the phone manufacturer or the wireless carrier, not Google. The Facebook app had been pre-installed on some cell phones, even if you don't have an account. But what happens if you don't even have an account? You can't remove the app, and the social network won't leave you alone. That's a problem. Facebook apps on some handsets are transmitting mysterious information in the background back to Facebook servers, even if you do not have an account with the social network, and the software cannot be removed without presumably unlocking or rooting the device. When you uninstall updates on these apps and disable their access, within minutes they have all somehow turned the ability and have reinstalled all the updates that was manually uninstalled. Facebook does offer instructions on how to disable updates for Android phones, but you have to do the research to find out how. The behavior of these apps and the way they insist on using background data tells us they are almost certainly collecting data. Who knows what the software is collecting and sending? The social network had not exactly covered itself with glory as of late when it comes to data privacy. Following the revelation of data harvesting by Cambridge Analytica, Facebook said it had to suspend around 200 other apps that were possibly violating user privacy. More recently, Facebook's mobile app alarmed Android users when, without warning, it began asking for root-level access on their device. The Silicon Valley giant said this was the result of a programming error by its engineers and that it had no real desire to get super user clearance. Well, then, is Facebook app trying to send and receive data on a handset who don't even use the service? Facebook insisted that no personal info is being trafficked, only things like the operating system version and device type that Facebook uses to keep the app updated. Now comes the bad news. That app is going to get and stay updated whether you like it or not. A Facebook spokesperson said the following. We have partnered with mobile operators and device manufacturers to pre-install Facebook apps on Android devices to help people have the best experience on Facebook right out of the box and during the life of the device. By having Facebook apps pre-installed, we ensure people have the latest version of the application installed on their device, giving them access to bug fixes, critical security enhancements, and other new product features. If Facebook is glued onto your Android device, it will stay there, pinging Facebook, and you don't even have to use it. In fact, you don't even have to create a profile. But the data flowing back must continue. This is way beyond the pale.
Reality distortion field is a term used by Bud Tribble at Apple Computer 1981 to describe company co-founder Steve Jobs' charisma. Tribble said that the term came from Star Trek. It was used to describe how the aliens created their own new world through mental force. Reality distortion field may not apply to Mark Zuckerberg. I think Mark Zuckerberg has adopted and enhanced Thengelis. It is a brand of speech full of impenetrable double talk that has an undeniable underlying sense and a method to the madness. Casey Stengel was the first manager of the New York Mets when the team was formed in 1962. Casey was famed for describing the players in the first year with such glowing terms that no one really understood what he said. The 1962 Mets hold the Major League Baseball record of most losses in a single season at 120. It is a record in futility that has yet to be broken. Casey Stengel had been in baseball since 1910 and was made famous for a game-winning inside-the-park home run in the 1923 World Series. From 1949 to 1960, he managed the New York Yankees to 10 pennants and 7 World Series titles. Mark Zuckerberg is on a mea culpa tour, and it just may be working. On March the 22nd, he appeared before the media to apologize for what had happened to personal data privacy at Facebook.
So this was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. We have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people. So our responsibility now is to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And there are a few basic things that I think we need to do to ensure that. One is making sure that developers like Alexander Kogan, who got access to a lot of information and then improperly used it, just don't get access to as much information going forward. So we are doing a set of things to restrict the amount of access that developers can get going forward. But the other is we need to make sure that there aren't any other Cambridge Analytica's out there, right, or folks who have improperly accessed data. So we're going to go now and investigate every app that has access to a large amount of information from before we lock down our platform. And if we detect any suspicious activity, we're going to do a full forensic audit.
On April the 9th of this year, he appeared before the U.S. Senate to apologize for what had happened to personal data privacy at Facebook.
We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry. I started Facebook, I run it, and I'm responsible for what happens here. Facebook is an idealistic and optimistic company. For most of our existence, We focused on all of the good that connecting people can do. And as Facebook has grown, people everywhere have gotten a powerful new tool for staying connected to the people they love, for making their voices heard, and for building communities and businesses. But it's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, for foreign interference in elections, and hate speech, as well as developers and data privacy. I believe deeply in what we're doing. And I know that when we address these challenges, we'll look back and view helping people connect and giving more people a voice as a positive force in the world.
And now, this week on May the 22nd, he appeared before the European Parliament to apologize for what happened to personal data privacy at Facebook.
Almost 400 million people in Europe rely on our services to connect and communicate with their friends and the communities that matter most to them. Dublin is home to our European headquarters. London is home to our biggest engineering team outside of the United States. Paris is home to a big part of our artificial intelligence research. And we have data centers in Sweden and Ireland. And we're building a new one in Denmark that will come online in 2020. By the end of 2018, Facebook will employ 10,000 people across 12 European cities, up from 7,000 today. And we will continue to invest in Europe in the years ahead. It's also become clear over the last couple of years that we haven't done enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, foreign interference in elections, and developers misusing people's information. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a mistake, and I'm sorry for it.
Well, since he started the Mea Culpa Tour, there has been an increase in the Facebook subscriber base.
I agree that we're responsible for the content, but we don't produce the content. I think that when people ask us if we're a media company or a publisher, my understanding of what the heart of what they're really getting at is, do we feel a responsibility for the content on our platform? The answer to that, I think, is clearly yes. But I don't think that that's incompatible with fundamentally at our core being a technology company where the main thing that we do is have engineers and build products.
You know, it might take some work for us to get this exactly right. This is something that we think is going to be a really good thing.
In tonight's segment on wearable and health technologies from Dr. Alfred Poor, he's going to be talking about mobile device reduces frequency of migraines. And he's going to talk about brain-body connections for powered prosthetics. And finally, he's going to talk about injectable sensors shown to work for years.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
A regular headache is no fun, but migraines are a whole different ballgame. They can be so debilitating that the sufferer can't stand to look at a bright light, have to go to bed. In some cases, they actually need to go to the hospital for treatment for the pain and the other symptoms. And so migraines are a serious problem for a lot of people. In fact, according to the Migraine Research Foundation, it is the sixth most disabling disease in the world and affects 39 million men, women, and children in the U.S. alone. Now, there's all kinds of medical treatments available, stimulation treatments to help reduce the pain, mitigate the symptoms. But one of the interesting things is that there are now treatments underway to help prevent the onset of migraines in the first place. One of these is created by a company called Eneura, E-N-E-U-R-A, and they've just done a peer-reviewed study in cooperation with the Mayo Clinic. What they did was they did a study with migraine patients, and they used their device twice a day and discovered that for about half the patients, they had half as many migraines in a month than normal. Now, the interesting thing about this is that this device does not use any drugs. It's a magnetic stimulation device using a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation. It uses magnetic fields to disrupt the mechanism that causes the onset of migraine headaches. The device is available only by prescription, and you rent it for 3 months at a time. Again, It's one of many devices out there, but it has been proven to provide relief by reducing the amount of migraine headaches that these test subjects had in the course of the study. So there's increasing hope for migraine sufferers that their problems can be reduced. Prosthetic hands and arms are getting increasingly sophisticated. They're powered so that they can mimic the muscle activities of a normal hand or normal arm. But one of the big problems that remains is getting feedback to the brain of the wearer about where the arm is in space, how it's moving. Researchers at the Cleveland Clinic have harvested a phenomena called the Pinocchio illusion to help provide feedback from prosthetic hands and arms. This Pinocchio illusion is kind of interesting. If you close your eyes and hold your nose with one hand, and then somebody vibrates the bicep on your arm that's holding the nose, you'll believe that your nose is actually getting longer. That vibration will send a signal to the brain that your arm is being extended. And since you're holding on to your nose, and you know you haven't let go, it will feel as if your nose is being extended at the same time. What these researchers have managed to do, they've reattached nerves to the remaining muscles in the arm of an amputee patient, and the motor nerves are used to trigger devices that will actuate the arm, cause it to move. But then the areas where the sensing nerves are attached, they have a way of vibrating the muscles where they're attached. It will simulate the sense of motion for the arm. And so it feels as if they can feel the hand moving. In tests, they've discovered that patients can adapt to this very rapidly with almost no training on the system. And they feel as if their arm is present, that it's a more natural feeling. At this point, the system requires them to be attached to a computer in a lab while they're doing this. But in the future, the hope is that the system can be miniaturized enough so that it becomes portable. It'll be part of the wearable system for the prosthetic arm and will give the wearer a much more natural feel for their artificial limb. Sensors are essential to digital health projects. They measure biometric data, be it vital signs or the levels of different biochemicals in the body that are important to analyzing health, detecting disease, or monitoring the process of treatment. The normal way that we deal with sensors is we strap them onto our body. We stick them on with adhesive, or we put them in a wristband or a headband or something like that, or otherwise attach them to our body. But this is inconvenient. Have to remember to put them on. Sometimes you have to take them off to recharge them and so forth. The ideal sensor would be one that you can set and forget. This is where the whole area of injectable sensors comes to play. Now, one of the problems with injecting something into your body, however, is that your body will identify it as a foreign body and your rejection reaction will come into play. You can get inflammation, there can be scar tissue build up around the device, and this is a major problem for people who want to implant sensors and other devices in the human body. A company called Profusa has developed injectable sensors. And these are made out of a hydrogel so that they are very compatible with normal body tissue. In fact, the body doesn't recognize it as alien, and in turn, this prevents the rejection reaction from happening. Another factor about these sensors is that they don't require any power. They contain material that gives off light when energized by other light, and the amount of light they give off depends on how much of the chemical that they're looking to measure is present. So it could be used for glucose, blood sugar, it can be used for other biomarker chemicals. And you just hold a sensor up outside the skin and it will get a reading. The interesting thing about this is that they injected volunteers with these sensors 4 years ago. And after 4 years, these sensors are still working and without any sign of rejection. So this is really kind of an exciting development because it means that you could get a semi-permanent sensor attached to you that could be read anytime you want, be much more convenient, and could be more accurate than some of the alternative ways that we have. In addition, the company is working on developing sensors that can measure a whole range of different kinds of chemicals. So this technology could become a very valuable tool for helping diagnose disease, monitor treatments, and getting better health outcomes.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Your taxes are filed, so you can now breathe a sigh of relief, right? Well, not quite. You need to now pack up all the paperwork and make copies of all the electronic records. Keeping your tax records, including all documents and receipts, is critical in the event that you are ever audited. It's also vital if you ever need to file an amended return due to a mistake or if you learn of a tax break you could have, well, taken advantage of but did not claim. So, how long should you keep your tax records? Well, let's take a look at the Internal Revenue Service's recommendations. 3 years. Typically, the IRS has 3 years to audit your return. In addition, you also have 3 years to claim a credit or refund from the IRS. Keep in mind the 3-year requirement means 3 years from when you filed your return. In some circumstances, however, the IRS suggests holding on to your records even longer. 6 years. In regular filing circumstances, the 3-year audit period is enough. If you did not include all of your earnings, then the IRS, well, they get a longer period to potentially audit your return. According to the IRS, the statute of limitations doubles if you underreported your income by more than 25%, meaning if you underreported your income, the IRS now has 6 years instead of 3 years to decide whether to audit you. If that occurs, you need to produce tax records dating back to the last 6 years. 7 years. If you make a bad investment, you have the ability to file a claim for a loss from worthless securities. You can also file a claim for bad debt deductions. In either event, you need to hold on to your records for 7 years. That is how long the IRS is allowed to question you about that specific situation. And then, of course, you have to hold some records indefinitely. The IRS recommends holding tax records indefinitely in some situations, mostly with regards to tax fraud. Hopefully, you're not in that category, but it's worth mentioning. No statute of limitations exists for tax fraud audits. If the IRS suspects that some fraudulent data was entered on your return, they can audit you at any time, even if it was decades ago. Further, if you did not file a tax return, you need to keep documentation on why you didn't file it. That can be tricky since you obviously don't have a tax return, and if you did not file taxes. However, the IRS requires you to prove you did not earn enough income to have to file taxes. What files do you need to keep? Well, now that you know how long you need to keep tax records, you may wonder what specific records you should keep. In short, you should keep every tax return and the supporting forms you need to fill it out. That might include W-2, 1099, mileage logs, expense tracking, alimony received or paid, K-1 forms, IRA contribution, etc., etc., etc. Even once the statute of limitations has passed, it's a good idea to keep a copy of a tax return for each year. What are the IRS record-keeping guidelines? Well, the IRS does not require you to keep a record of your taxes in any specific way. You can practice whatever form of record-keeping works best for you. Just be sure that you can easily find all materials that you may need in case IRS ever asks. If you prefer to keep hard copies of your tax records, the best way to store them is in a locked fileproof safe along with your other important documents. On the other hand, if you prefer digital record-keeping to physical files, there are no specific IRS guidelines with regards to record-keeping. As long as digital copies are legible, the IRS will still accept them. You will, however, want to make sure that you keep digital records on file until the statute of limitation is up. Also, take extra precaution to safeguard your information from hackers. Well, why am I bringing up about how long you need to keep copies of your supporting material? Because in the past, I've had all electronic records backed up on floppy diskettes. When it is requested, you may no longer have a diskette drive available. Well, I've also kept electronic records on optical media. One day, you may not have an optical media drive available, and for many people, their only system may no longer support an optical drive. More recently, I have been storing it on USB flash memory drives. Although I have not experienced it, I've had other USB flash drives which had been sitting on the shelf for more than a year idle to be unreliable when needed. Well, I actually have all these scenarios covered. I stack all my electronic files together with all years needed meeting IRS requirements onto one external drive. This means I only need to make sure that I have media device available, which covers all prior years of filing. I maintain multiple physical copies of the returns on an external hard disk drive, and they are then copied onto other external hard disk drives where they are then stored in multiple locations for safekeeping. Backup is one leg of the backup process. The ability to recover data is the second leg of the process. And finally, and most people don't realize this, having a peripheral device to read the media is an absolute must. A word to the wise. Stack all your electronic files together onto a single device. Make sure you have multiple copies of that device. Store it in multiple locations. And before you do it, test for readability of the data. And do not, and I repeat, do not put all your backups in one physical location. Marty Winston on Home Automation will be talking about surveillance, recording, and artificial intelligence. Marty talks about things that few people with surveillance cameras ever think of, like calibrating the rows and columns in the image to precise locations in the real world, using the height and width of the pixel shifts to tell whether the thing that moved is a human intruder or a deer, detecting faces and recognizing whether they're familiar, and reading license plates and more.
In our cybernetic house, there's no visual surveillance indoors. Privacy is more important. But outside, cameras watch everything. In the past several weeks, I did one segment on how to configure two RAID arrays to mirror each other for a close-to-failure-proof storage asset, and one segment that talked about the amazing Seagate Skyhawk AI 10-terabyte surveillance drives with a more than two-century mean time between failures. But there are still a couple of surveillance-related topics I just glancingly covered in the past that I think deserve more attention, so let's go there now. I want to touch on pixel trigonometry and why situational calibration is helpful. I want to talk about all the places where recognizing things is helpful. I want to talk about Blue Iris software, a very economical Windows offering that I very much prefer to any of the high-priced commercial packages, and about how H.264 video compression works. Also, about why surveillance is heating up to be one of those boom market things that can be so distracting and confusing. We could potentially connect more than 5 dozen video cameras, but our plan is for closer to half of that, most of them surrounding the house and pointing outward on perimeter patrol. Pixel shifts, events that change parts of the image a camera sees. Pixel shifts can trigger selective recording of that camera's video. Think about it. It makes no sense to record what all those cameras see if there's nothing there to see. It also quickly erodes our available disk space, so recording only when something moving triggers a recording is a good overall approach. Early on, it seemed obvious that the cameras could tell when somebody was about, oh, for example, to walk into or across a sprinkling zone. We could delay or pause watering that zone. Naturally, it later seemed obvious that if the system ever identifies an unwelcome visitor, the same control over the sprinklers could make sure that he or she can't stay dry. How do we know the correlation between what the camera sees and locations in the actual yard? We're using cameras that don't move. No tilting, no panning, no zooming. So within a camera's video image, every horizontal row of pixels represents some given angle of elevation, and every column of pixels represents some given angle of azimuth. It will take some work, but we have to make sure that the relationship between those angles and places in the yard isn't arbitrary. What if we could find a way to calibrate not only each camera, but every camera? This takes a lot of homework, but it's a subject you're unlikely to see discussed elsewhere, so let's give it a minute or two. This is an exercise in pixel trigonometry, and as far as I know, nobody makes a surveyor's transit for surveillance cameras. It can get complicated given how many houses are on sloped lots, not perfectly flat ground. For starters, we need to figure out the camera's height and the angle of view. You know, the direction, the center of its lens points. Do you have one of those laser distance measurers? Hardware stores and home improvement chains carry them. Start by determining a point that's exactly 20 feet out, perpendicularly from the wall the camera's mounted on, or you pick a number, it doesn't have to be 20, and make sure it starts directly beneath that camera. Put a peg or marker at that point in the yard. If you can, measure the distance up the wall to the camera, but in any case, measure the distance from the 20-foot out point to the camera. Do that for every camera. It goes a lot faster if you don't try to do it solo. Adjust for the slope of the ground. The ranging laser and a tape measure can help. Get a long rope and a couple rolls of fairly thin, half-inch or thinner, brightly colored tape. Carefully band the rope at precisely 3-foot intervals. Or again, you can choose a number, 2 feet, 3 feet, it really doesn't matter, just some known interval. Run that rope horizontally across all of those 20-foot out from the wall markers. Then go inside and bring up each camera on the monitor, one at a time. You might also want to take a vertical stick out in the yard that's at least 6 feet long. It will help if you can glue a level to it. You want it to be perfectly vertical, and put tape stripes on it every 2 feet or every 3 feet, your choice. When there's something in the yard, that vertical stick can provide a double check for its height, even in a system that can use the column's pixel count and some trigonometry to figure it out. The team at Blue Iris Software is working cooperatively with me to add a feature to an upcoming release that will make the next part easier. You will only need to move the cursor or a crosshair to each mark on the rope and, using a new feature in their interface, enter the range, distance to the rope, and how many feet from center. The software will then calibrate the pixel row and the pixel column into where that is in the yard. Depending on the size of your yard, you may want to repeat this exercise at distances of less than 20 feet, more than 20 feet. That lets the software build a more complete virtual grid of your yard. But until that new version of Blue Iris gets here, there's an approach you can use with any surveillance software. Get your best ruler and measure how far up the screen the rope is and work out the ratio of that measurement to a measurement of the screen's full height. By the way, if you can think of another easier way to calibrate a camera so its pixel row and column positions indicate a somewhat precise real-world position, absolutely let me know. When it comes to identifying the position of something in the yard, we're most interested in the bottom of the object. Remember, real objects involve clusters of pixels, both vertical lengths in their columns that indicate their height and horizontal row runs that indicate their width. Once calibration data is in the system, height calibrations and trigonometry can give us the height and width, which also gives us a ratio. But have you ever seen a flat fish, like a flounder? Looking at it from different angles would result in very different measurements. That's why we add in one more calibration measurement, the horizontal distance between cameras. For the Blue Iris user interface, it's pretty simple. Pick the name of the camera to the left and enter its separation, then do the same for the camera on the right. And also identify if either one is a corner camera with its next neighbor at a right angle. Why bring in the neighbors? Well, we can take a pretty fair guess at something's position and shape from one camera. The position information is a lot more reliable if we can triangulate from two. And the shape gets a little easier to identify with that. Add a third camera's image, and the shape data becomes very useful, in part because we don't really need to know a lot about it. A person who's standing will have a height greater than width, and we're generally interested in those who are more than 2 to 3 feet tall. A deer will have more width than height, and that's less confusing to identify if we're not using only a front-on shot and no other. We really don't want surveillance recording to trigger for every squirrel, bird, raccoon, coyote, or deer in the yard, but when there's a person out there, we tend to want to record that and sometimes have the control system respond to it. Is it somebody we know? We may be able to determine that, at least roughly, because of a little AI we're using at the mailbox. There's a camera hidden in the back of the mailbox that can see whether or not there's mail in it, but it also gets a peek into the outside world every time somebody opens the mailbox. That view won't always include a face, but when it does, we'd like to know whether it's someone familiar, like me, or somebody unfamiliar. That involves two tasks, with the second one dependent on the first. We start with face detection, which simply means determining whether or not there's a face in the picture. We then do something less than full-on with facial recognition. We only need a rough set of facial feature landmarks, and the database can keep score of how many times those landmarks have shown up before. We can optionally do that same pair of tricks with people outside the house, and that lets the system skip triggering an event recording when only familiar people are out there. And the same again once more at two of the four cameras at the apron of the driveway, where they can catch a glimpse of both drivers and passengers. But they have another recognition job to do. What's coming in the driveway? Just a car or something with a logo on it? If we have a library of still images of logos, recognition software can do what's called a three-space transposition to determine whether that logo is visible on a vehicle. I think there might be, oh, maybe 50 we want to recognize. Here's some examples. Police, sheriff, ambulance, FedEx, DHL, UPS, the mailman, the exterminator, the landscaper, utility meter readers, dry cleaner, florist, Domino's, Pizza Hut, and if you're very lucky, the publisher's clearinghouse prize patrol. The house is about 400 feet up the driveway from this camera at the apron, and this gives it a chance to alert anybody who's home about who's there. A more robust bit of recognition at the apron of the drive comes from the other two cameras, aimed at the back of an incoming or outgoing vehicle, reading and relaying the license plate information. Holy cow, reading license plates and faces and positions. Isn't all of that overkill? Well, it certainly can be, but remember, our context is a little bit unusual. We have a sensor-rich environment supporting a cybernetic house that does many useful things in our interests, meaning it keeps track of many potentially useful things, including many we may never need to know. You could go your whole life without an intruder in the yard, and we hope that you do. But police tell us that when home break-ins begin in a neighborhood, they often continue for a while, and what they find most useful in getting things back to safe again are good, recognizable images of faces and evidence of their presence at a particular place at a particular time. You don't need a cybernetic house for that. You just need something like Blue Iris to capture timestamp video from motion triggers. If you want to ring the doorbell before packages or pizzas reach the door, you don't need our 100 computers to do that. But there's a very good set of reasons for wanting to incorporate recognition tasks like these. Time and space. When you can cut down on the number of things that will trigger a recording, you can get your available disk space to go for a much longer time before you fill it up. Know what most surveillance recorders are likely to record several times a day, even if there's nobody there? The pixels that shift as dark turns to light and then dark again, both because of the planet's spin and because of clouds. To that end, specifically for fixed view camera systems, a pattern recognition approach can eliminate these image-wide shifts from acting as triggers. Speaking of time and space, I strongly recommend that you consider cameras with H.264 or H.265 built in. These are compression standards that very much reduce the amount of data needed to transfer or store detailed video. They work within the image, like when you compress JPEG files, but they also compare video frame to frame to frame and only move the data that corresponds to things that changed. One of the biggest reasons that we're at the beginning of a boom in video surveillance is because really good quality cameras cost a lot less today than they did just a few years ago, as little as a quarter as much. Or, of course, you have the option of getting really high-end features, and those cameras will probably still cost a little less, but they'll cost a lot more than the simple ones. But be careful. There's a downside to overspecifying, not just to your budget for cameras, but also to unnecessary negative impacts on the performance of your NVR system and the husbandry of its storage. So, AI can help surveillance systems make smarter decisions about what and when to record, what and when not to record, and help gain you a lot more days per terabyte for your surveillance storage drives. Just remember, it's always possible for all of that effort to go to waste if you don't back up, back up, back up. Ready for my close-up, Mr. Key?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Schedule computer club meetings in the tri-state Northeast region. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a meeting on Thursday, May the 24th. Topic of presentation is Setup and Configuring a Home Network. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they'll meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting Friday, June 1st, 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on net neutrality, Tuesday, June the 5th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting Thursday, June 7th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. The Long Island Mac Users Group will be meeting Friday, June 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they'll meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting on Thursday, June 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the NYU Silver Building, room 405 in Manhattan, New York. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, June the 26th, 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. All these computer club meetings are free, and they are open to the public, and we hope to see you at the meeting. And by the way, if you have any questions about computing and you just don't know how to get an answer, or you want to know about a particular product you're interested in buying, hey, attend some of these meetings, and they'll be more than happy to help you if they can. And there's no such thing as a dumb computer question. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or www.wbai.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.